For the third time in 3 years, monster movie fans went to theaters and drive-ins across the country in 1956 and heard the familiar Herbenstein da-da-da music and saw their third Gilman movie, this one titled The Creature Walks Among Us. I'm Tom Weaver, and I'm sitting here today with someone who was the right age in the mid-1950s to get the most out of these movies, the grand old man of monster movie fandom himself, Bob Burns.
Hi, Tom.
To give us a fan's perspective on growing up with these creature movies. And you were a teenager in 1954 when Creature from the Black Lagoon came out. Talk about that experience and seeing it in 3D for the first time.
Well, that was actually the first real 3D movie I ever saw. And I had always seen 3D shorts once in a while, so I always loved 3D, but I never knew what I was going to see here. I'd seen pictures of the creature, so I knew I was going to like him. I had no idea what the movie was about. I stayed there and saw it, and these were the days you could still see it in the theater and sit there for like four or five runs if you wanted.
Right.
I did it for all four or five runs. The 3D in this was amazing. Is the stuff they shot in Florida, the creature looked like he was actually floating out in front of you. It was really something.
In the theater he did.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Before you go on, this is the Edison Bridge in Florida with two local stand-ins. In the convertible, this is an insert shot at Universal of Jeff Morrow and Lee Snowden. But that's Florida, that's the Edison Bridge, and they're pulling up to a yacht basin. Actually, it's called the Yacht Basin in Fort Myers, Florida, and a 102-foot yacht called the Vagabondia. And then when you see the Hollywood actors again, once they get on board, Rex Reason, etc., now we're at Universal. So, go on, about seeing Creature for the first time in 54, and when you were a teenager, right?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes, and it was just wild. I mean, I'd never seen anything quite like it, and I think of shooting 3D underwater, which had to be an incredible task in the first place to do that with those big cameras,
mm-hmm.
is it? It just looked real. Everything looked real. I mean, like I said, the water disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So all you saw was the stuff floating around, and it came
inside
right
the movie theater.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It almost came right off the screen. And they had some great effect stuff where they would shoot the harpoons at you and things like that. And people were ducking all over the place, including me.
Uh-huh.
And it was a marvelous thing. And like I said, I stayed there and saw it about five times. It's the same, first day I ever saw the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. Your field is in
medicine. We're looking at here Greg Palmer, Maurice Manson. Lee Snowden is the girl in the middle, and Jeff Morrow, and Rex Reason, and we'll talk about all of them in a little bit. Could you talk about seeing, I know you had a little bit of an incident in a theater once concerning a 3D movie. Could you talk about that for a moment?
Yes, well, I was going with, my soon-to-be wife, Kathy. I didn't know it was going to be that soon then, because we'd been going together for a long time, and she had never seen a 3D movie. And Charge of the River was a Western where they did a thing with a bunch of arrows, Indian things, and it really looked very extremely realistic. I mean, you would duck when these arrows came by. So I took her to see this movie, and when the arrow attack came, I suddenly reared up over the back of my seat with an arrow in my chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it disrupted
the whole thing. But you had brought along.
Yes, I did. I faked this whole thing. I'd seen the movie already. Kathy didn't know what to do. I mean, there I was with this arrow in my chest, and all of a sudden, the lady behind me almost had a cardiac arrest. It ended up they had to stop the film because people were throwing glasses all over the place. Thought that stopped the 3D effect.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get out of the theater in a real hurry.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite an experience. So I guess that's why we ended up together, because he said, well, he's got an imagination anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how much I love 3D, and these movies in particular. This is just the Creature series. It's just a real, real fun thing.
And the Creature, of course, became one of your favorite movie monsters.
Absolutely. He's one of my absolute favorite monsters, and I'm so glad that these are coming out now so people can actually see them and see them in really good condition, and it's going to be a real thrill.
Mm-hmm.
Providing, of course, we can give him a concentrated dose.
Well, don't look so doubtful, Grant. It's worked before.
Can you paint a little bit of a picture of how much equipment they had to bring underwater to shoot Creature from the Black Lagoon and Revenge of the Creature 3D footage?
Well, they developed their own camera, their own 3D camera, which is actually two cameras that shoot in, it shoots into a mirror situation. And it's quite large by itself. And then putting it into a container, a watertight container to put underwater had to be another, it had to be an immense job to do that. And even the people that had to create that had to really know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to handle that stuff under the water and trying to focus everything. And they had to have some fill-in lights underwater. So they had to put some minimum lights, because in Florida it's really clear water there. And the sun really gets down deep in there where you can see stuff. But that had to be a logistic job of some magnitude, I'd say. But boy, it was worth it because the shots they got were so incredible. I mean, I don't think anybody could have done it better.
Similar machines are being manufactured
And it was a portable underwater camera that they'd never, which they had never done before.
That's true. It was totally portable because they had to just be able to swim around with it, you know, and push it around and move it. So it wasn't on a tripod or anything like that. They were, the camera guy was just, they were pushing it around. And luckily it was in water, so it was, you could kind of float, which is good. But it was, oh my gosh, it was, had to be a real problem.
Mm-hmm. And I know you love the creature to the point that you actually befriended some of the people who made the creature suit.
Yes.
And can you talk about some of them and who we know about and who we don't know about?
Well, Chris Mueller was a sculptor friend of mine. He had come over from Germany with his father years before and was got into the business by sculpting facades and things for buildings, you know, the real, real fancy facade stuff. And then he kind of just stumbled into the movie business. He was just very good at it. And he ended up actually sculpting the creature head, actually both creature heads for the first film, Rico's head and Ben Chapman's head. And, of course, they're, one guy's bigger. Ben is a big fella.
Ben is the land creature.
Right. And Rico, the underwater creature, was a lot smaller, so he had to actually do two heads.
Well, maybe there's Ben and Rico
right
there.
Well, that's probably pretty close to what their real sizes are if you saw them. That's right. Ben is about 6'5", I think, something like that, and I don't know exactly what Rico was, but that's about the size. But he had to make the heads look as close to, you know, the same. Now, you never saw those creatures together in the film. You always thought it was one person. In fact, most people I talked to that, that saw the film thought it was the same guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Throughout the whole film.
Oh, sure. I grew up thinking it was the same guy. Sure. I started reading about these movies.
But Millicent Patrick actually designed the creature. And like I said, they had other sculptors that did the hands, the body, the feet and stuff, but Chris actually sculpted the head and did just a beautiful job on it. And, of course, Bud Westmore was the head of makeup, so he got the credit, and that's just the way it was in those days. The head of the department always gets the credit, no matter what. But he didn't do a lot of the physical work, if any, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but, you know, he was there, and he oversaw everything, of course, you know. But they, these guys actually did. Jack Kevan was another hands-on guy that helped making the molds and all that kind of stuff, and pouring up the rubber, and actually, if he needed to apply it, he would apply it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first creature suit was really interesting because it was made over, they didn't have spandex in those days, but it had a suit sort of like spandex. And they glued the pieces on Ben in that first one, and the same thing with Rico.
Mm-hmm. Now, glued it onto a body stocking.
Yeah, it was a body suit. Yeah, body stocking. Mm-hmm. Today it would be spandex, I'm sure.
Right.
But in those days, it was, you know, like a body stocking. And it took a considerable amount of time to do that, to build them up. But then they found quicker ways of doing it. Like with this particular film now, the actual creature itself only appears in one sequence. And that's where he jumps up on the boat and he gets lit on fire and the whole thing. And Al Wyatt was the stuntman that wore that suit for that whole sequence. And that suit, they just made a two-piece suit, a front piece from the neck to the ankles and a back piece, and just put it together, and they used a revenge creature head.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there he just wore that, and then they made it look like it was all burnt and everything after it got burnt, and then he just, you know, was on the boat and did the thing. All the other stuff of Rico under the water, of the creature, is all from the original film.
In this movie?
Yes, in Walks Among Us here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all from the original film, but they're different takes that you didn't see before.
Some of them are different.
Yeah, so you can tell, oh, it looks kind of new, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was from the old film. But you can tell the old, if you know the old head, you can tell what it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that saved them a lot of money and a lot of time, and it was already in 3D.
Right.
So it was cool, and they didn't, of course, this wasn't in 3D. They didn't have to worry about it at all, just throw it in there.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Now, you've got a color still of Rico in the creature suit on a pier in Florida for this movie, so they obviously did bring him in and suit him up and everything. But if they shot any footage of him, it did not end up in the movie.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I haven't. I couldn't see any if it was.
Right.
Because all the stuff I saw is the old head. You can kind of tell.
The wife there is Lillian Molieri, and the actor is Paul Fierro, playing a fisherman. They had a couple of different versions of this scene in early scripts, one where he only spoke in Portuguese, and his hand is supposed to be horribly mangled, and in one of the old scripts, one of the things he keeps saying over and over is, "Can you heal me? Can you heal me?" And they know that they can't, so it was kind of written in a sad way in some of the early scripts, whereas in the movie here, it's just fairly straightforward. They just come in and he tells them what happened to him with the creature. You talked about Bud Westmore before getting the credit for the makeup, even though he was probably less involved than the people, a lot less involved than the people under him. Can you talk about Joseph Gershenson and the music for these creature movies?
Yeah, now, Joseph, he always got the credit of music supervision.
Mm-hmm. A big, big prominent credit on this movie.
Big credit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing was, he didn't actually create any of the music for these films. He was, here again, the head of the music department, and the way it was worked in those days, the head of the music department usually got the credit. Now, the reason for this, though, is most of the music they used in the creature pictures, a lot of what they became library music, that mm-hmm. they call it, done by a lot of different composers. You know, like Irving Gertz and Henry Mancini, Heinz mm-hmm. Rommeld, Hans J. Schalder, and Herman Stein.
Herman Stein with
now,
the
Herman
ba-ba-ba.
Did that. Dun, 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 yeah, he did that part, you know, and stuff. So all of the music from all of these composers in this particular film are these by these guys.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't give them all credit.
Right.
That this wasn't done. So Joseph got the credit for it. However, I understand he was a very good composer himself, and it wasn't he couldn't do it. He just didn't have the time to do it and didn't do it. Well, if he got all these composers doing it, and they used all of this music from them, and there's a lot of music in here that, you know, was used and became what they call library music mm-hmm. over and over and over again. And that's a cost-saving thing.
Right.
And the music's the same feel, so it works fine.
Mm-hmm. David Schechter, you must know him.
Yes.
Is an expert on monstrous movie music. In fact, that's what he titles the CDs he puts out of movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon and others. He tells me that Creature from the Black Lagoon had 44 music cues written for it, and Revenge of the Creature, amazing, 72, although a lot of them were just... it has 72 cues of music, a lot of the music written for other movies. The Creature Walks Among Us has 35, and most of it by Henry Mancini, which actually sort of blows my mind. I certainly never suspected when I was a kid that Henry Mancini worked on movies like this, but I guess we all have to start somewhere. David Schechter writes, Creature Walks Among Us features an almost entirely original score, despite the fact that by now there was a lot of library music written for both Creature and Revenge of the Creature that could have been used in this third film. 28 of the 35 cues in Creature Walks Among Us were written specifically for the film, with 18 of them composed by Henry Mancini, 5 by Irving Gertz, 4 by Heinz Rommeld, and 1 by Hans Salter. Creature Walks Among Us features a lot of lovely lyrical cues, many composed by Mancini, and it's the most listenable creature score due to its infrequent use of the creature theme. Some of Mancini's music can be heard during the lengthy sequences in the second and third reels when the scientific party searches for the creature via scuba equipment and boat. This was one of Mancini's earliest films where he was allowed to write so much music for a picture, just under half an hour of music. And I think that's just amazing. And I do agree with David that this does have, I mean, we all love the da-da-da, but it sort of got done to death in the first two movies. And this one, I think, has a really, really nice score, especially when the doubles for Rex Reason, Greg Palmer and Lee Snowden go underwater in a few minutes.
Yeah, no, it was actually a very good score, very, mm-hmm. very good. And I think everybody just remembers, you know, Henry from Pink Panther or Peter Gunn or something.
Yeah,
and
didn't
realize that he's very, very good composer. He could do any kind of score. It didn't matter what it was. I mean, these are hard things. He could do it. But his music in here is very beautiful, as a matter of fact. There's some really beautiful stuff in here.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the ordeal of putting on and wearing a creature suit based on what you've heard over, well, based on your own experience, we could bring in a little bit, but based on what you've been told over the years by people like Ben Chapman and Rico Browning.
Well, to wear a suit, any kind of a creature suit, is difficult. I mean, it really is difficult. You can't be claustrophobic, for one thing.
Mm.
If you are, you're in trouble. That's all there is to it. Because, like the creature mask, for instance, fits very close to your face. It's molded. The inner mold or the inner face is actually off of your face. So it fits like a glove, literally. So that's very tight. The suit itself is very tight, and the rubber, it gets very hot because your skin can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
So when you sweat, it has nowhere to go. I mean, literally, it just stays with you. And that gets very uncomfortable after a while. And in these suits, these guys were from head to toe, literally. You know, their hands were covered, their feet were covered, everything was covered. And I thought they all did a remarkable job in working these suits and getting the movement that they got in them, you know, to do. Like Ben was great. And Rico in his swimming, my gosh. I mean, that swim that he developed for the creature, sort of side-to-side motion,
mm-hmm.
is just, you've never seen anybody swim like that ever, before or since. So that's the creature's own swim. I mean, he developed that whole thing for that. And it's wonderful. And he has grace in that. So, and knowing how that suit had to fit, that was not easy for him to do.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a beautiful job. But you can't be claustrophobic in one of those suits, I'll tell you.
They're doing a little trick here. Unfortunately, I've lost track already. They're doing a little trick here if you want to continue to tell once they get underwater which one is Greg Palmer and which one is Rex Reason. One of them has two tanks on and the other has just one tank on. So you can look, you can go back and look, or you can look at the end of the scene. And by telling how many tanks they've got on, you can tell who's who throughout this whole sequence.
All right, Fogg.
There's a magazine called Reminisce, written for older readers, and they recently ran an article by James Jackson Jr. of Miami Shores, Florida, and he wrote about being Greg Palmer's underwater double. Out of the blue, this guy comes up with a great color shot of himself and the creature from the making of the movie, and he wrote a nice two-page article, or three-page article, about being Greg Palmer's underwater double in this movie. He said that he was just a guy living down there, and he saw... Oh, no, actually, he heard on the radio that there would be auditions for a movie, role in a movie, taking place at Wakulla Springs, which was just 20 miles from his house, and he thought he'd give it a try. And he found out they wanted an underwater swimming double for Creature Walks Among Us, and he really wanted to do it, so he said that he had experience with scuba equipment, even though he really hadn't had. He just wanted to be in a movie that badly. And then once the picture started, $200 a week he was going to get paid, and a buddy of his, a guy named Dick Wells, got the job of doubling Rex Reason. And once the job started... And scuba diving can be dangerous.
Oh, very.
And once the job started, he was afraid to ask how to do things because he knew he'd lose his job if he asked, so he just had to go ahead and do it. And he said, one funny thing he said was his buddy, the one doubling Rex Reason, had a bald spot, and they didn't go for that, so they rubbed carbon paper on his head before he went down so that you couldn't tell he had a bald spot because they didn't want people thinking Rex Reason had a bald spot. And anyway, so this guy goes down not knowing how to scuba dive and afraid to ask, and, you know, needless to say, he got into trouble down there. At one point, he touched his feet on the gushy floor of this body of water here, and he got stuck, and he had to be helped out because he went down to his ankles and just couldn't get out. And it was a really, really cute article.
Checked the right by 20.
He revealed a couple of secrets also, not very important secrets, but when they spray the rotenone, he said that was just milk.
Yep.
Which I think they've been using throughout the series, milk and cream, for the rotenone you think you're seeing. And it was just a really cute article to come out of the blue by this guy, and it was really good reading.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stories, I'm sure, that will still surface someday out of some of these films that you just don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these doubles, really, you know, underwater, of course, with the mass on and everything else, body-wise, really look like the actors. I mean, they're very close to the actors,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Here's our first stock shot from Creature.
Yep, there he mm-hmm. goes, coming out. Now, one way you can tell in the creature here is you'll see he actually has no eyes. You know, they didn't have the eyes in the original, so Rico could see when he's swimming under the water. And that's one way you can tell.
That it's all footage
from
the first movie, shot
for
the first
film,
movie,
yeah.
whether we saw it in the first movie or not.
Yeah. But here again, with a clever editor, you
mm-hmm.
can do almost anything you want, you know.
Yeah.
It looked pretty good. But I always thought these doubles really, really did look like the actors. I
mean, mm-hmm.
you almost bought it that they were the actual people they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And probably one reason for the extra tanks, too, is so you would identify who the people are, in a way, in case you kind of got lost.
Right.
You would know.
Mm-hmm. It's not that vital in this movie, but in the Creature from the Black Lagoon, when it's Richard Carlson, who's kind of the good guy, and Richard Denning, who's not so good a guy, in the original Creature, it's sort of important to know which is which once they get underwater because of, you know, what the things they do within the scenes underwater.
Yeah, you need to know.
Mm-hmm. This movie is written by Arthur Ross, who also co-wrote the first movie. He was approached for Creature Walks by producer William Allen, who, you know, asked him, would you do one more? And at that point, Arthur Ross had a new baby and he needed the money, so he took the job. And like his script for Creature, this one also had some tentative, tenuous roots in scientific reality. He sort of based it around the old argument of whether what we are is controlled by our genes or our environment. And he took it from there. I told him that the story reminded me a little bit of The Island of Dr. Morrow, with a mad scientist trying to surgically make the Gill Man closer to human. But he sort of poo-pooed that, and he said that he wrote what he did, A, to get the Gill Man away from jungle settings, and B, and I thought this was interesting, he said the Gill Man was half fish and half man, and we'd already seen how the half fish operates. How does the half man operate? That's what I decided to do with this movie. And actually, you know, it is sort of a neat idea to humanize the creature and then see how he's different for a third movie, just to make things a little different.
Oh, I think so. And, mm-hmm. and plus, you've done just about all you could do underwater and in the jungle.
Yeah, definitely.
You've just about covered it all, you know.
Mm-hmm. And even in the city.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's that great stroke of Rico's. Oh, that is just so cool, the way he swims.
Right.
It's just amazing.
In the first two movies, if you watch the first two movies back-to-back, which I had never done until just a few years ago when I was getting ready to interview William Allen, the producer. Mm-hmm. For the first time ever, I watched the first two movies one after another, and all of a sudden, you know, call me dense or whatever, it had never occurred to me before. how much, if you put those first two movies together, it's like King Kong, with the expedition going into the jungle and the girl and finding a monster, and the girl and the monster thinks the girl is cute, and they capture him and they take him back to civilization, and he escapes and he's looking for the girl, and it's just point by point, it's just King Kong. And I mentioned this to William Allen and asked him if King Kong was part of his thinking when he was devising the idea in 1952. For Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I guess nobody had ever asked him that before, because he just started laughing. He said, absolutely. And I got the feeling this was the first time he ever found out that anybody had noticed that it's just complete King Kong ripoff.
Yeah. Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. It all goes back to that, obviously, yep. But this is really point by point. And in Revenge of the Creature, there's a lot of things in the script, some of which they did, some of which they didn't do, that make it even more obvious that the person who wrote Revenge of the Creature, Martin Berkeley, he was really going by King Kong, and that gets talked about on the other commentary. Lee Snowden is back in a white bathing suit in this movie, like Julie Adams in the original. In an early draft of the script, the conflict between Dr. Barton and his wife is, they said it, they lay it out for you even before the, just as the movie starts. You remember this movie starts with them in the car, and she's speeding, and he's giving her these disapproving looks. Well, in the early script, they're in two different cars. She's in a Mercedes-Benz and driving like a bat out of hell, and Dr. Barton is behind her in a Jaguar XK120, and he keeps dropping farther and farther behind because she's got the pedal to the metal and going around curves with screeching sounds and everything she could do to antagonize him, and she's looking in the rearview mirror, and it's delighting her that she's falling farther and farther behind, and so that sets up the conflict right away when you find out that they're husband and wife. Creature Walks Among Us, it's got enough for creature fans. I mean, it's got the music, it's got the creature, it's got a certain amount of action, so creature fans are happy with it, but really, the conflict, I think, between Jeff Morrow and his wife and all the talk about genetics. I think they came up with an idea for a 60-minute movie and unfortunately had to pad it out to an 80-minute movie. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that's it's pure pad. I mean, but what can you do? That was the length of the movies in those days. You had to do it, you mm-hmm. know.
They're shooting the milk.
There's the milk, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, now she's just floating around. Oh, this is when she's got the Raptures of the Deep, I believe it's called.
Yeah, that's what they call it. When I was a kid growing up, I would see this on the Late Late Show. I'd be 9 or 10 years old or whatever. And in a way, it struck me in a way as the most, at that age, as the most adult creature movie, because it had the marital conflict and kind of like a soap opera element. And they'd get off into talking about genetics and, you know, is it our gene structure that affects what we are, or is it the environment? And if science could change the gene structure, would we be ready for space? And it was all going over my head. It sounded like double talk at that age. But I said to myself, you know, maybe I'll appreciate this more when I'm older. Yeah. And every time I saw Creature Walks from then on, I kept hoping that it would sound less and less like double talk. But you know what?
It's double talk.
It's all double talk.
Yes, the whole thing is double talk. Uh-huh. That's it. You know?
So it suffers the curse of being about 15 minutes too long. But other than that, it's a hell of a movie. Yeah. You have worn full-body monster and ape suits throughout your career, and I think, if I'm you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think the first time was in a she-creature suit, the she-creature being sort of a creature from the Black Lagoon rip-off monster. Am I right about that?
Pretty close, yeah. Okay. Paul Blaisdell did it, and it sort of had a creature look a little bit. And, yeah, I did all the TV spots for it, you know, the TV appearances and all that. Paul didn't want to put the suit on, and he played it in the movie. And mm-hmm. so I.
And you two guys were close enough to the same size that you could get into that suit? Because I keep hearing how small he was.
Well, we were exactly the same size.
Oh, is that right?
Originally, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I was 130 pounds then. Of course, it's hard to look at me now and even think of that.
I never have seen any of your baby pictures, Bob.
And you never will, I hope. But anyway, but yeah, so I was the same size as Paul. We're the same height, actually. Uh-huh. And because I'm not a tall guy. And so it was easy for me to get in the suit. And it was fun. But I could see, you know, I really have an appreciation for people wearing any kind of animal or monster suits. It's rough. It's not easy being an actor. And I see why a lot of actors wouldn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people want their faces seen anyway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's hard for an actor because this is not easy to do at all. Now, there was a scene of the creature back here a little bit where they were still under the water here that I noticed is a scene from Revenge.
Oh, is it?
That creature, because he had the eyes. Mm-hmm. One quick scene, he goes by. So they did use something from Revenge in there as well, mm-hmm. but they already had the footage, so why not use it? You know?
Right.
And I don't blame him. I would do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So how was a Paul Blaisdell full-body monster suit, how was the construction of that different from what they did for Creature from the Black Lagoon?
Well, apples and oranges, really. Quite a bit different, yeah. The way Paul did it, he built it over long johns, for one thing. Instead of a body stocking, he had long johns.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just take foam rubber, like the stuff you would get in couches, to put in couches and stuff, to stuff them, you know. Mm-hmm. And he would cut the foam rubber and make a pattern out of it and actually glue it on with contact bond cement, which if you do it right, that'll hold an elephant to a wall. That mm-hmm. stuff is very strong.
Is there somebody in the suit as he's gluing stuff on?
No, he's stuffed with a newspaper.
Oh, just stuffed with newspaper, okay.
Yeah, stuffed it with newspaper and mm-hmm. then glue them on. And then the head he would actually sculpt up out of rubber, only he didn't use a mold to do that. He just sculpted it on a face piece. He had a rubber face piece he made up and sculpted it on. So he did it the hard way. I mean, there was really no way. Now, if he'd have had the, you know, the lab that Universal had, the technicians at Universal had, which were many, mm-hmm. you know, he could have done a lot more, I'm sure, but he didn't have those, and he only had like 3 weeks to build this whole thing, and probably got about $2,000 for it, and that was about it.
You know? Right.
But the research that went into the creature, the first creature, was like a year in researching everything and seeing what materials to use and what to do and how to do it. And so it was really quite different. He was very primitive the way he made his suits. And, I mean, the outcome's the same. I mean, it's a suit. It looks pretty cool, you know, mm-hmm. and all that. But the creature, I think, probably has to be, to this day, honestly, the best creature-type suit ever made for a person. I mean, there's been other guys around. There's alien things and all kinds of other stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, guys in suits. But I think the creature is still today the best. That's why he's such an icon. He's right up there with Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, the Mummy, all those guys. I mean, he's as popular, if maybe not even a little more popular than
they some
are.
Of them, sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the design itself is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And the execution was great. The acting was good. I mean, he was just, he's an all-around great American monster.
Yeah. And the suit looks so functional. That's why it's almost believable. There's Frank Chase. You might remember him as the bumbling comedy deputy in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. He had a pretty good, like a co-starring part in that practically.
Here he's just talking that one.
Yeah. Here he's just on and off in 10 seconds as the steward.
Yeah. But, no, the creature, I think, is just, he has such a following. I mean, it always will from mm-hmm. now on. And,
well, talk about the reaction that that Ben and Rico get when they go to conventions from fans.
Good heavens. The first one I went to with Ben, Ben had never really done any of these things before. And in the first couple he did, he had no idea the fan base for the creature. And he was swamped. I mean, literally, there must have been 500 people lined up to see him.
Wow. Where was this?
This was in Wonderfest, a place called Wonderfest at one time. And then he did Chiller Theater. Well, there's a lot of shows. He does a lot of them now.
Yeah.
He does tons of shows now.
Oh, you can't keep them away.
Good heavens. He and Julie Adams are always doing them.
Uh-huh.
And then they finally call Rico in,
mm-hmm.
finally.
Yeah.
And Rico is, he told me at the last show, he's really surprised because he had no idea. For him, it was just a job.
Uh-huh.
He did the job and sort of it, you know. But, I mean, they have thousands and thousands of fans. And they can't sell and give away enough pictures. I'm telling you, everybody wants their autograph. So that's proof right there.
Yeah, 50 years later.
Yeah.
What monster guys from today are going to be hounded in 50 years for their autograph?
They could care less.
Yeah.
You know, really. I don't think any monsters today have been created that are going to be remembered 50 years from now. That's
mm-hmm.
for sure. But, you know, but these were, the creatures were just really something. And
mm-hmm.
Ben is still just knocked out by the whole thing. He still can't believe it. And Rico now, too. He just, you know. But you just don't know the popularity of these characters, you know. They become, there's model kits, there's toys, there's drawings, there's photo, everything.
You've got six of everything, I know.
Pretty much, I think. Yeah, probably so. I'm cursed with the collector's curse.
Oh, I know that.
But it's amazing. But the creature has to be, I think, one of the all-time great things. And that's why, you know, putting out this box set is going to be incredible because you've got all of them together. They're all here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an amazing thing to be able to have all three pictures and just be able to look at them anytime you feel like it.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, you know, because I do that all the time.
Mm-hmm. The captain in the middle is an actor named David McMahon. In The Thing, he was the general who sends Kenneth Toby up to the North Pole. He's the general who's always yelling at everybody to close the door. And Jeff Morrow. Did you ever meet Jeff Morrow?
Yes, I did.
Nicest guy in the world.
He is nice. Mm-hmm. He was he's gone now, of course,
yeah.
But he was the sweetest man. He mm-hmm. really was. And he was almost embarrassed by the popularity sometimes that people would bestow on him. You know, he just said, well, I'm just an actor, you know, that stuff. But people loved him. He did some great films.
Mm-hmm.
Did This Island Earth.
Right.
Universal film, which was really good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he did some good films and a very good actor.
I think so, too. Absolutely.
Very fine actor. I mean, you know, he's done some turkey movies, too, but he saved them just by being a good actor, you know. But I found him a very, very charming guy.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed him. Was Dupar's, is that the name of a restaurant out here?
Yes.
Okay. I interviewed him. I called him up and asked him if I could interview him, and he said, let's get together at a restaurant called Dupar's. Yeah. And I went there with my brother, and there he was, and we sat down at a table and got appetizers or whatever we got. And I talked to him for, gosh, it had to have been a half hour or 45 minutes about how he got into the acting and some of the plays that he did starting back in the days of, you know, Katharine Hepburn and Catherine Cornell and people like that, and The Robe, which was his movie debut, and This Island Earth, and we were getting into Creature, and I look over at the tape recorder, and I could tell the tape is moving the little cassette is moving very erratically, and my heart just sank, and I asked him, you know, could we stop for a minute, and I open it up, and I rewind it, and it rewinds erratically, and, you know, this was, you know, the tape recorder that had worked 1,000 times before,
uh-huh.
It had just died. And he takes it, and he says, you know, let me look at this, and he fiddles with it for a while, and, you know, obviously, we'd done practically the whole interview, and there was nothing, and, my heart is down in my shoes now, and so he just looks at me, he says, well, how about tomorrow night, right at this table, we'll do it again, and I can breathe again, because, you know.
What a guy.
You would think that most actors would just, you know, you had your shot, kid. Thanks for wasting my time.
Right.
And blah, blah, blah. Now, he tried to fix my tape recorder. He insisted we come back the very next night. We started right at the beginning. He didn't give me the short versions of any of the stories. He told them just as well as he did the first time, if not better. And, I just love the guy because of what he did for me.
Yeah.
Because he really rescued the situation.
Doesn't surprise me at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very charming guy.
And unfortunately, he did get Alzheimer's before he passed away. As a matter of fact, his memory was not all that. He was a super guy, and he remembered what he remembered, let's put it that way. But he didn't have a lot of stories to tell about these movies when I met him. But he certainly did the best he could, and he was a lovely guy. Rex Reason, have you encountered him over the years?
I just met him one time at a show. One time.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to be a very, very congenial guy to me. I mean, that guy, he was very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I told him, you know, I was a real fan of his, too, well, from This Island Earth and this film. And, and he seems to like the films. He thought they were a lot of fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun.
Actually, he probably did have fun. Like, Laurie Nelson didn't want to do Revenge of the Creature, you know, didn't particularly want to do Revenge of the Creature when she was assigned to it, but she had a ball on it. And Rex Reason was the same way. When they asked him to do Creature Walks Among Us, he told me that he didn't want to do it, but this was the days before Universal Pictures were on TV, or really any major studio pictures were on TV.
Right.
And he said to himself, I'll do it. It'll be in theaters for however long it's in theaters, and then it'll be gone, and nobody will even remember I did it.
Right.
So that's the only reason that he did Creature Walks Among Us. He said, if I knew it was going to be on TV eventually and that people would remember it beyond 1956, he said, he might not have done it. Actually, his only, he didn't have that many memories of the movie. As a matter of fact, about his only really vivid memory of the movie is, it should be vivid. Later on in this scene, there's a fire in this very boat, and at one point, the fire got a little too close to him, and he jumped overboard, and there's a little sharp piece of metal sticking out of the side of the boat that got him on the ankle, and he's still got that scar.
Oh, wow.
So he's got a little reminder on his body for the last 50 years that he was in this movie. Obviously, the long shots of the boat where you can't see the faces and shots like this are all shot in Florida by the second unit. And when it comes in for a close-up, then you're on the process stage at Universal, and the actors just crowded into this little boat on a tank or something with the rear projection of trees and whatever you see behind them.
Yeah, that's what's here, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're speaking of not wanting to be in a film. You know, Julie Adams didn't want to be in the original Creature.
Yeah, it seems like nobody wanted to make these movies originally.
Oh, I don't know. That just doesn't sound... And then, of course, when she did it, she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And she still loves the film to this day.
Yep.
She loves the film.
She was another one that was a little reluctant to stick her toe in the water convention-wise,
yes.
too. But now she finally has.
And she's a veteran now.
Yeah, the lines go out the door for her.
She's a veteran. Oh, yeah. I mean, she can't, can't even get away for lunch.
No, know? Absolutely.
But this stuff matches well, though. You know, I mean, I got to say that for Universal. They matched everything here pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this lighting all matches, you know, because this is strictly a stage, of course, with the RP. But it matches all this.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a very good job.
And we got the creature going to make his
first action.
You know, here we are. It's like, where are we? Like 40 minutes into the movie. Mm-hmm. The first action comes 40 minutes into the movie.
Right.
And the other movies got into the action a lot quicker. That's another reason some fans prefer the first two to this one. We got the creature coming up in an action scene in just a minute. You want to start talking about it now?
Yeah. Well, it'll be a scene where the creature actually jumps up on the boat here. And like I said, it's Al Wyatt, a stunt guy, and this is the suit that they just made, the two-piece suit to put it together, because he's in a very short scene here. And then they harpoon him, for one thing. They shoot a couple of harpoons into
him.
Yes,
they do. I love the fact they warn Greg Palmer right before the creature jumps on board. He says, if you have to shoot him, aim for a non-vital spot.
Yes.
He starts going for the heart away.
Right, yeah. He knows where he's going to shoot him. Or in the lungs, either way, you know.
Exactly.
If he had lungs, you know. Uh-huh. Which he will later in the film.
He's making a full turn.
Al also had to do what they call a fire gag in this, because he gets doused in gasoline by his own doing, as a matter of fact, and he gets on fire. Now here he is. This is Al. Here, just real quick. This is the only, like I said, new footage they shot of the original creature, you might say, at all. And now he'll come and he'll do his nonsense on the boat here. And when he gets burnt, well, here they're pouring the gasoline now. They're going to light the torches here now. Mm-hmm. They figure the fire might keep him away, but it doesn't seem to bother him at all.
Yeah, well, they need the torches because the light is broken now.
Yeah, so now they got to see, you know. Mm-hmm. And so now there he comes, and he's going to do a bad thing now. He's going to jump right up on this boat, and it's a pretty good trick. I mean, obviously they had him on a cable, because there's no way in the world that the guy can really jump up on the boat the way he does it, because he just has nothing to jump from. But it's still a good scene.
Does he jump off and they run it in reverse, or do they pull him up with a cable?
I think they pull him with a cable.
Okay.
I'm almost sure of it. It looks like it to me, because the way the actors are reacting, here he goes. Whoop. That looks pretty odd.
Vital spot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right in the heart. Let's get him right there. All right, now get him in the kidneys. There you go. Got him. Good. Fine. Oh, I'll just drink this stuff. Oh, that's it. Now, here we go. Now, when he gets hit with this now, he's actually on fire, but they embellish the fire, too. That's also a superimposition. Now, here's a dummy. It's obviously a dummy.
Yeah.
It was because he was static. He didn't move at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there was not enough flames on him, I guess, on Al. So they actually embellished the flames in the lab and did some optical stuff and put more flames on him. They did the same thing in the original creature, too.
Mm-hmm.
He gets lit on fire.
Because
I guess maybe with the rubber and stuff, it just didn't burn the way they wanted it to burn, probably. You know?
Right.
So they did embellish it, but it worked fine.
And with Al Wyatt doing the fire thing in the first picture as well.
Yeah, that was him. Yeah, so this is like old hat for him. He just came back and repeated himself, so to speak. You know, but it worked well. Oh, now there he's pushing a tree around there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. David Schechter, the music guy, told me that they wrote music for this scene, and they even performed and recorded the music for this scene. And I guess at some point in the editing process, they figured a scene would play better or more suspenseful or whatever without music. So even though music was written for this, it was not used. The same is true at the end of the movie, when the creature is on the rampage through the house. At one point, as he's entering and before he starts smashing the place up, the music just stops, and from then on, it's just the heavy breathing and all. And actually, I think that...
It's more effective.
I agree.
More effective. I mean, music has where its place for music is great.
Mm-hmm.
But this, they didn't really need it in here. I mean, you're trying to show a point here, for one thing. You know, he looks pretty burnt here. It's great. What they did, they just took the suit, and they put all kinds of charcoal smears all over the suit and kind of caked it on. And it really looked pretty much like he was burnt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the last you're going to see of the original creature in this film now.
Mm-hmm.
He's done.
Mm-hmm.
He took the suit home. That's it. Retired. He's through. And now Don McGowan steps into the role here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Don McGowan, I really felt sorry for as far as wearing a suit. He had to wear this head that, here again, skin tight, hands and feet. And they had him in this sailcloth thing. And they had to pad him. I mean, he's a big man by himself. He was 6'5", at least. But he didn't have shoulders like this guy has. It's like the Hulk.
Yeah, nobody does, right?
Mm-hmm. They had to pad him so much. And I'm sure it was foam rubber under there. And shooting it out in the sunlight, he does a lot of stuff outside. And that he had to just cremate in that thing. I mean, he had to really get hot. In wearing gorilla suits, I know how hot it gets.
Right.
If you're out in the sun. And he had to, I've got to hand it to him. And I thought, working a character like that doesn't have much expression. I mean, he's just kind of got a mean expression all the time. I thought his body English was pretty incredible. And that has a lot to do with somebody working in a suit. It's all body English, really. Ben had it. Rico's got it, you know. And now Don McGowan does some really pretty good stuff because that face is pretty immobile. It doesn't do a whole lot. But by his actions, I mean, like, you know, he can look sad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. You wouldn't think he could. But his body English, it makes it work. And it's pretty amazing. So I give all these actors a lot of credit that work in suits.
Right. Well, maybe not in this scene, but later in the picture, it's Don McGowan with the mask, with the hands, and then wrapped up like a mummy, too.
Yeah, so it had to be real hot.
My God.
Yeah,
and I went to acting school for this?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and no lines.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's the problem. But the thing is, too, you know, in these days, too, you know, the lights were a lot hotter than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
The film stock was a lot slower, so the light was really pretty hot. So, and he had probably had to lay there for days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don McGowan got paid $500 a week on a two-week guarantee. Rico Browning also made $500 a week on this movie as the utility stuntman. And Don McGowan once played Greg Palmer's brother on a Gunsmoke. And there was a gunfight in Dodge City, and Don McGowan got shot. And Greg Palmer had to pick him up and carry him off camera. And he said he picked up Don McGowan and put him over his shoulder. And he said, Don's feet were dragging on one side of me. His head was dragging on the ground on the other side of me. He was so big. He said those were the longest 10 steps he ever took in his life to get him off camera.
Big man. Big
mm-hmm.
man. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, he was Frankenstein, too.
Yes, he was. He was in that Tales of Frankenstein pilot that they did. Yeah, he played the monster. So mm-hmm. he actually played two monsters. I don't know if he did any more after that, but that's the only two I knew about.
Mm-hmm. What's it like once you're in a monster suit or an ape suit or whatever and you're on the set? Do people treat you like just another actor, or do the attitudes of the people around you change?
Usually change.
Is that right?
Yeah, at least I find that in a gorilla suit for sure. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they just think you're another animal in the set, and they just treat you like that pretty much. And you don't. I'm sure, like with Don here, they probably treated him very well, you know. But some of the gorilla stuff I did, they forget that there's a guy in a suit. It's
mm-hmm.
like an animal.
Yeah.
And you don't need him. Put him off to the side and throw him some hay or something.
Yeah, they sort of forget that how hot it is in that thing for the poor guy, and nobody seems to. You told me once, nobody seems to hurry things up or really worry about what's going on inside that suit with you.
No, I've always said that I think a director, any director around, should have to wear a monster suit at least once in his life to get the appreciation of... Rick Baker said the same thing before, that you know, like that. Mm-hmm. But now I'm there, and he's got to be really hot in this thing. I mean, he is so wrapped up.
I'm looking at him.
Boy, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure he doesn't have the mask or anything on here, you know.
Right, but in a minute he will have the mask on under the bandages.
Right, but he has to be really hot, because you know it takes, you know, God knows, this is probably take 10, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? And the hot lights and stuff, he has to really be boiling under there. In fact, I'm kind of wondering, it could even be a double.
Mm-hmm.
Might not even be him in this particular scene. It's hard to say.
Right. No,
of course, $500 a week, it's probably him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's probably him.
Exactly.
But that had to be real. And that had to be as uncomfortable as the outfit itself, I would think.
Mm-hmm. The director of this movie, by the way, you talked about the director a minute ago, or directors in general. Mm-hmm. Director was a guy named John Sherwood. He was an assistant director at Universal for 8 years. He made his debut as a director, directing two shorts, and Creature Walks Among Us was his first feature. Even went to Florida with William Allen, the producer, to Miami to scout locations for this movie, although I think everything he did once directing-wise, once the picture got started, was on the Universal lot. He also did Monolith Monsters, and I once tried to find him because years ago I tried to find him. I thought he'd be a good subject for an interview, and called the Directors Guild and asked people and blah, 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 and nobody knew what had happened to him. And, you know, it's always sort of embarrassing when you find out that you've been looking for somebody who died practically before you were born. He was 52 years old, and he went back into second unit directing. And in 1958 or 1959, he was in New York City doing second unit scenes for Pillow Talk, and he died of pneumonia at the hospital for joint disease. Just 52 years old. And here I am in the 80s looking for him and calling everybody, and nobody knows who I'm talking about.
Wow. Well, I thought he did a very competent job of directing this.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, the direction moves very smooth, I
mm-hmm.
think, you know.
It's very professionally done.
Yeah. It is, yeah.
If he had a better script, it would be a better movie, obviously.
Yeah. I think that's what 90% of the directors would say to you every time,
I think, too,
especially in these days. You
exactly.
Because they were just kind of contracted guys, and mm-hmm. just kind of came on board to direct stuff.
Right. One of the other minor flaws of this movie, again, something that the people who made it had no control over, is Universal had let a lot of their contract players go by 1955. All the studios were feeling the pinch, and Universal let a lot of their contract people go. So, like in, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon had a real decent cast for a B-movie, and Revenge of the Creature also.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in Revenge of the Creature, even the uncredited people, you get... Brett Halsey is in there. I mean, playing bits, you get people like Brett Halsey and Clint Eastwood, and John Saxon was even involved. So So they had that going for them. You had, you know, studio movies where everybody in it, credited or not, was somebody.
Right.
But now we get The Creature Walks Among Us, and they let all their contract people go, and, you know, who are these people in the supporting cast?
I
mean, the first four or five people are recognizable, but once you get beyond that,
Doctor, look.
The guy on the right is Maurice Manson. He was a stage actor. This is his first movie. Mm-hmm. And the guy next to him was a teacher. He was a drama teacher and occasionally played small, almost always uncredited parts in movies. And now, all of a sudden, you know, Universal feeling the pinch. Here's this guy in one of the co-starring roles.
Wow.
And his name is James Rawley. And then, again, on the right is an actor named Maurice Manson. He was on stage for years and years. I talked to him once. He said he was he did a lot of the March of Time shorts, but this was his first feature film. He came out to Hollywood with the National Company of Tea and Sympathy with Deborah Carr, and while he was out here, he got a job in this movie. And he said, I guess you can tell this was John Sherwood's first movie. He said he's got this fair-sized part and a lot of dialogue, and it's his first movie, so he wants to do a good job. There, we're looking at him right now. Mm-hmm. And he goes to John Sherwood, the director, and says, this doctor I play, you know, how do you see him? How do you want me to play it? And John Sherwood sort of hemmed and hawed and finally goes, he's a nice guy. And that was all the direction he
Thank
got.
You.
So he was completely on his own for his first movie. He told another funny story. He knew William Allen from way back in the days of New York and the Mercury Theater, I guess. He said he went into audition for a part. There's our Don McGowan under
there
all the bandages. Heinz Rome-held electronic keyboard music on the soundtrack. He went in to audition for a part in a play that Orson Welles was doing, and he gets to the theater around 10:30 at night, and there's William Allen, you know, sort of in charge and rehearsing the cast, and he says, you know, I'm here for an audition with Orson. And Allen says, well, he's not here. And a couple of minutes go by, and Orson Welles shows up with some buddy of his, and they've got, you know, liquor in their hands, and they go up to some office, and Maurice Manson is now waiting to be called up to the office to audition for this part. And then the night goes on, and it gets to be 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's just sitting there in this theater waiting, and finally, about 5 o'clock in the morning, he goes to William Allen again, and, you know, look, I've been here since 10:30. Do you think Orson is going to see me? And finally, they get it all together. They go up to the office. There's Orson and his buddy, completely drunk. They have him read this comedic part in this play. And Maurice Manson starts reading, and Wells just starts laughing. And, well, that's good. And he takes that as a good sign. And he reads some more, and Orson Welles just roaring. And, oh, you're the best Shakespearean clown I have ever heard. And just almost on the floor with laughter. So he finally, after waiting six and a half hours, he finally got his audition, and he went home, and he heard nothing. So he calls the theater, and, you know, I auditioned for Orson, and he really liked me. Do I not get the part? And they check with Orson. Well, he doesn't even remember you. He was so drunk that by the time the guy auditioned at 5 o'clock in the morning, he was too drunk to even remember the guy the next day.
Oh, man.
So
that's not a pleasant experience.
The glamorous life of the actor, right?
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this head, this particular head, I've never been able to ascertain who actually sculpted this head.
Uh-huh.
Because Chris Mueller was not there. And he also did not do the revenge head either. He only did the first one. So I have no idea who did it. Could have been Jack Kevan, because Jack was a very good sculptor as well. And he was still here. So he might have done it. But I thought they did a really good job of taking the creature, though, and making it look semi-human.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good job. I thought it was it looked fine. It really looked okay.
Mm-hmm. One thing about the creature, I love the creature suit. And I even like the burned creature in this movie. When they're wet, they really, really, really look cool. But
yes.
When they're dry,
they look like rubber.
You can tell them for what they are when they're dry.
Yeah, you can kind of see rubber. Yeah, well, later on, when he's outside, they put, like, glycerin or something on him, and he looks more like lizard skin,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a natural, shiny look about it.
Right.
But, yeah, that's the trouble with all foam rubber, is it does have a very dull look to it if it doesn't have anything on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know the funny part about this with Greg Palmer, he looks so much like Rock Hudson in a way. He almost looks enough like him to be his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered if that ever messed up his career at all. I mean, he was in pictures, I think, even with Rock Hudson, I believe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a very good looking guy, you know, in his day. And I've always wondered about that, you know, if maybe he was too close or something. Of course, when he became a character actor,
mm-hmm.
gained a little weight, got the beard and stuff, and did the stuff with John Wayne and all that.
Oh.
Boy, he's an incredible actor. this guy is really, really good.
Oh, I love him in Big Jake, where he's got the machete, and he's the... Oh, you just...
He's really...
You never wanted to... You never rooted so hard for a bad guy to get killed as Greg Palmer in Big Jake.
He was great. And I used to go over and see Glenn Strange do some gun smokes, and he did quite a few of those, too.
Palmer did quite a few of those.
Yeah, he was great. He was a very, very good actor.
But, mm-hmm.
Well, all these people are good actors, though. I mean, they're really fine.
Mm-hmm. For millions here we go with another just this, another scene, just to unfortunately fill running time, I'm afraid.
This is where I went out and got popcorn and a cold drink.
They must have sold a lot of popcorn for
yeah,
this movie.
Yeah, I'm sure. This is a three box movie, I think.
First movie's with 3D. This is three box.
Three box popcorn and Cokes, yes, because this got very technical, especially for kids. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even a kid.
Well, it doesn't even really make sense. I don't know how technical it is. It just doesn't even make sense the way they're expressing these things. Greg Palmer was born in San Francisco. He's Norwegian. He started in radio, came to pictures around 1949. One of his first jobs in Hollywood, he auditioned, screen tested. They were going to do a TV series of Little Abner, and he had a scene with an actress playing Daisy May, and the actress was Marilyn Monroe.
Holy cats.
Yeah, he doesn't know if that film exists anymore, but I think we'd all love to see it if it did.
He would have made a good Little Abner, too.
I think so, yeah, absolutely.
He had that face. He could have pulled it off.
Mm-hmm. And he's a big guy. I mean, another inch or two on him, and he could play a monster in a movie.
Sure could.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Went to Universal in the early 50s and was under contract there for several years. He was let go at the same time that just about everybody else was let go, and he came back and did this as a freelancer. And then he went on to do From Hell It Came as the native who's killed and comes back as a tree.
Yep.
That's as exciting as that sounds. Zombies of Moritau, Most Dangerous Man Alive, and then tons and tons and tons of Westerns. As he got big and heavy, he sort of began to specialize in Westerns and character parts and things like that.
He was a good bad guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, you'd love to hate him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He made more of an impression as the bad guy later on, I think.
And when you meet him, he's one of the nicest guys you could ever possibly meet.
Right.
Well, all the bad guys were.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Strange was like my dad, and he was that way.
Right.
You know, he was always the big bad guy, you know.
Right.
And he was the most lovable guy in the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg Palmer's not exactly a good guy in this movie.
He's kind of a rat.
He certainly is.
When he gets his, you don't really care that much.
No, not at all. In an early draft of the script, I mean, the wife resists the advances of Greg Palmer throughout the movie, but in an early draft of the script, there's an implication that she is willing, and in fact, where they go diving in order to get away, in order to have their little moments together.
They
go diving, and that way, you know, who's going to know what's going on?
Just the fish.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Lee Snowden had a very brief career in the 50s, a lot of TV work, and Kiss Me Deadly and several other pictures. There's a Western at the tip of my tongue that I can't come up with. And
very beautiful lady.
Oh, beautiful. Absolutely. And a short-lived career, and then she married an accordion player named Dick Contino.
Oh, good.
And, and she was his wife until she died of cancer at a fairly... Well, she's lighting up right now.
There's your reason right there.
Yeah, exactly.
One of them, anyway. Yep.
Died of cancer at a fairly early age. You mentioned Glenn Strange. Talk about his creature connection.
Well, he was 6'6", and he, of course, played the Frankenstein monster in three of the movies for Universal. Last one being Abbott and Costello and Frankenstein. And when they were going to do the creature, they thought of him on account of his size. And they actually called him in, and he was going to see about testing for it. But then he had heard that there was a lot of swimming involved.
Mm-hmm.
So he could swim, but he just said, well, I'm not that kind of swimmer. You could, you know, you got to go down a few feet under the water. And he said, no, I just don't think so. So he turned it down. And, of course, years later, after Ben Chapman got it and they used Rico for underwater stuff, Glenn said, I could have done that thing after all.
I guess
I didn't do it.
They didn't get across to him that he did a land creature.
No,
he thought he was and in the cave all the time.
Yeah, he thought he was going to have to do the whole thing and swim,
mm-hmm.
do all the swimming, too. And they said, you know, there's an enormous amount of swimming in this film.
It sure was. For Rico, though, not whoever was playing the creature in California.
Yeah, but he had no idea, you know, so he turned it down. But he had made a good creature because, I mean, here again, he's used to wearing makeup,
mm-hmm.
and he made a good monster and stuff. He could have done all that stuff really pretty easily, you know. But here again, I think Ben had a lock on it, though. He did a beautiful job. Nobody could have done better than he had.
Right, exactly. Now we're coming up on another underwater scene, so you want to start talking about that?
Yeah, this is interesting.
We'll still be talking about it when the scene begins.
This is interesting, yeah. He's making his first move here out into society to see what's going on. Oh, I just look at that and say how hot that guy had to be inside of thing. That's all I can think of. He had to be so hot. Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Greg shouldn't have... Now, you can see his size. by Greg's size. Greg's a big man.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have any build-up shoes on here.
Right.
Now, he's just a big, big guy. And with all that padding, because he was a lot, lot bigger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Looked like Tor Johnson on some sort of weird steroid.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And they stressed throughout the movie that how the creature will turn out now that he's burned is based on, or some of the scientists maintain, how he'll turn out is based on how he's treated. And he comes out of the room, and the first thing that happens is Greg Palmer pulls the gun on him.
Yeah. So already he's, mm-hmm. you know, he's getting in trouble.
Right. All right, so...
All right, now he's going to go back. He's going to go
back in Florida.
All right, now all of a sudden, this is Rico, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only footage in the movie is this scene here.
Yep, mm-hmm. This is it, of him actually doing something. Well, he's got the head on, which I think probably is just putting with the same heads that I think they put on Greg. So the head looks a little large. And they padded him with the big shoulders and stuff.
Oh. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. The same head they put on Don, not Greg.
Don, I'm mm-hmm. sorry. Yeah,
okay.
They put him on. And then he just... They padded him in the shoulder area, but they didn't pad anywhere else. And the water pressure, as you'll see here in a minute, squeezed all the rest of the clothing close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the shoulders really look kind of outlandish
right.
compared to that, because they didn't think about the water pressure doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So in the on-land scenes, Don McGowan looks like a fullback on steroids.
Yes.
And now that it's Rico Browning at the bottom of the sea, his head is big and his shoulders are big, but the rest of him are real slim, like the creature always is.
Pretty much, yeah. You can kind of see that in a lot of the scenes here. You can see the shoulder pads when he holds the arms out like that. You can really see them.
And here comes Florida. This is the guy I talked about before. This is the guy doubling Rex Reason. This is the guy who had to rub carbon paper on his head to hide his bald spot.
That's very funny.
In his pajamas, and now they're about to have their little fight. And now we're about to get, you know, after years and years of hearing in interviews from Rico and other people hearing all about hose breathing here after the fight ends, because the creature can't breathe and is all tuckered out, we get an on-camera demonstration of hose breathing.
Certainly.
And you want to talk about how hose breathing was done?
Yep, well, he's got the hose here. And what he does, he puts it in his mouth, and then he can just, you know, suck the air in that way. And you can see all the bubbles coming up, and that's when they're exhaling,
mm-hmm.
of course, and the bubbles come out. And you can see all the bubbles here. So he's actually, the stunt guy here is actually giving him air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for real, on camera.
Which is the way it's done off camera.
Exactly.
In all the other creatures.
This
movies.
Is the way that Rico got his air
mm-hmm.
When he was off camera as the creature. He'd be out of the scene.
In the first two movies.
Yep. Bring the air hose down to him, and mm-hmm. he would get his air this way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rico could hold his breath for almost 5 minutes, too. I mean, that was an amazing thing
mm-hmm.
to be able
I'll
to
talk
do.
About it, yeah.
But, so, actually, they're really doing it here, and
mm-hmm.
of course it fits, because he's supposed to be giving him oxygen here.
Right.
That is the way they did it in the film.
Now, the interesting thing is, he's probably wearing a head that was made, Rico is probably wearing a head that was made for Don McGowan, so there's a lot of room in it.
Oh,
it's bigger than his head. And you can see, watch the bubbles just boiling out of his head as they come out of
the
top.
Yeah, it looks like his head's going to blow up.
Right. The air is, he's getting some of the air, but all the air that's going up into the top of the mask is then coming out of the foam rubber.
Absolutely,
it looks like
sure.
it's boiling with bubbles.
Because the foam rubber's very porous,
mm-hmm.
so it's going to come right out. And yeah, he probably had another inch and a half
mm-hmm.
above in there that just filled up with air.
Yeah.
It's got to go somewhere, and up it goes.
In Creature from the Black Lagoon, they took enough care to get the Rico and his safety guys. They smooshed out the bubbles before he would go on camera in Creature.
Right.
But in Revenge of the Creature,
quite a bit.
You could see the bubbles in that movie also coming out of the top of the creature's head.
Quite a bit, yeah.
The interesting thing to me, that really, really surprised me after hearing from all the actors over the years and reading how long Rico Browning could hold his breath, he was a pack or two a day smoker, starting at 19. And
that's amazing.
Got up to 5 packs a day.
Wow.
Can you imagine how long he could hold his breath if he weren't a smoker?
Oh, my God.
He'd still be down there.
He'd still be, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Now we're at
Stock Universal Houses here.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
The house they're about to drive up to is called the Dabney House, built by Universal in 1947 or 48 for a movie called a Western called Tap Roots, and the family name in the movie was the Dabneys. So you got the optically, you got a mountains and a
little lake. It's
and
good.
A it's lake it. Exactly in the ocean or whatever it's supposed to be in the background. It's obviously not on the Universal lot.
No,
that's added optically. But that's the Dabney House at Universal, and what Universal did when they gave a house a name, when they built a house on the lot or for any reason, they would give it a name based on the movie they built it for, and then the name would stick.
That's
so
it.
This was still the Dabney House in 1955. I think it's also in Tarantula and any number of other movies over the years.
No.
Is it still on the lot?
No, they tore it down when they did the tour.
Mm-hmm.
It finally went. Now, here had to be some very hot scenes for Don McGowan here, because this is all outside during the day, and you know it took him hours and hours to shoot this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And in the summer.
Yep, and with all the padding and stuff, he had to actually be dying in this thing. Really, really had to be very hot. Universal had some really good matte painters in those days.
Oh, absolutely.
Those mats were really
good.
Well,
here, look at Greg Palmer. He can almost play the creature. Put some lifts. Well, not in this shot. But
no.
Now in this shot, they remember to...
Yeah. See, they got him oiled up now. See, his face is oiled up, so now
that's
he looks...
That's glycerin, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was glycerin on it, yeah. Which actually eats the foam rubber, by the way.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't do the foam rubber.
Yeah, put the padding on Greg Palmer on the left there, and he'd be as big. He'd be almost as big as the creature.
Yeah, you just have to give some lifts to him. That's about it. He can do it.
Jeff Livingston of Universal's 445 Park Avenue office wrote a letter September 28, 1955. He didn't like the title. He wrote a letter to somebody at Universal out here in California. It sounds as if the monster was just... The Creature Walks Among Us title he didn't like. It sounds as if the monster is just ambling around making trouble. And he suggested a long list of alternate titles, including one he liked, The Creature Stalks a City. Quote, which is provoking and, at the same time, lends itself to the King Kong type of ads with cars and buildings being pushed around. And other suggestions of his include The Creature Turns. He didn't like The Creature Walks Among Us, and The Creature Turns is better.
Boy, wow.
The Creature's Jungle, The Creature Against the Sky, The Roaring Creature, The Creature's Secret. Oh, speaking of roaring creature, what is the roar of the creature?
It's a pig.
Is it a pig?
It's a pig.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you heard, like, you know, yell like a stuck pig?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened. They stuck him, I guess, or something.
Uh-huh.
It was combined with some other animal growls, too. But that main growl, the big roar thing he has, that's a pig.
Mm-hmm.
Pig sound.
Interesting. The roaring creature, the creature's secret, Creature at the Crossroads, and you read the rest of them, starting with Creature from Out of the Sea.
That's a creature from out of the sea. 50 fathoms under to the creature? Wow, okay. The Creature and the Mermaid. Oh, that's a good one. The Creature Rises in the Everglades. The Creature, Dead or Alive. Oh, wow. The Creature Has Two Faces. Mm. The Creature's Mastermind. Now, that just leaves me completely boggled. And Creature from the Roaring Everglades. You know, I think Creature Walks Among Us worked out best after all.
I love when you find in the studio files lists of titles that well-meaning people came up with for movies
Good
that are just so
heavens.
Completely ridiculous and inappropriate. Now, this is on the Creature. This is on the Universal lot, obviously. And in a few minutes, the creature is going to be attacked by a mountain lion. And actually, that idea recycled again. Universal had in the original. Creature, the original creature from the Black Lagoon, 1954. They had a scene where he's attacked by a jaguar, which they didn't use. But probably maybe Arthur Ross wrote it, and now 2 years later,
recycle,
yes. Absolutely.
I believe it. You think that's always true, Doctor?
Arthur Ross's son, Gary Ross, who's kind of a big name out here in Hollywood with pictures like Pleasantville, he's talked about doing a creature remake, and so has help me with the name Del Toro.
Oh. Guillermo?
Yes.
Yes, he would love to do it.
Mm-hmm. Talk about what you know about all the movie makers who have over the years talked about doing a creature remake.
Well, John Landis, of course, wanted to do it at one time.
Back in Jack Arnold days when he would have let Jack Arnold direct it.
Yes, he wanted Jack to direct it.
20 years ago,
yeah,
25
long time
years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few directors have talked about doing it, but it's just never got done. It's the kind of thing, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, I think that's really what it boils down to. Rick Baker, at one time when John Landis was going to do it, was called in to create some creature designs. And they were nice. I mean, it was based on the creature, but maybe a little more streamlined or something. You know, you can't do it. I guess they figured they can't do it exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally hope it really never gets done. It's my personal feeling, because, I mean, the original Creature is the perfect film. Leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get it any better. Those actors were great. I don't think you have actors today that could really pull it off as good. I honestly don't think so.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But
also, you wonder how many of the old monsters could work in movies today set in, 2004. Because, I mean, you know, if the creature got loose in the city, somebody reached for their cell phone, they'd call 911. There'd be cops there with a riot gun in 2 minutes, and that'd be the end of the movie.
It'd be gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They'd have to make the creature much bigger, and they'd have to make him armor-plated and big as... Well, now it's not the creature
now
anymore.
Now we're talking about Godzilla.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's the problem, too. That is, yeah. So, no, it would... Well, audiences too sophisticated today, too, for one thing, I think. You know, there was an innocence back in the 50s here that people had when they saw films, I think, that they could, I don't know, it's a different feeling now. It mm-hmm. really is a different feeling with movies, I think. Now, the creature's being serenaded here, which is kind of nice, you know. That never happened to him before.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to dig it, I think.
Yeah, he likes the girls.
He does like the girls.
He carries them off. And maybe someday I'll find an old monster movie where the monster carries off the girls and does whatever he intends to do with her. Because they always get intercepted.
Always.
I think they just, in the old movies, it seems like they just get interested in the girl and carry them around for the sake of carrying them around. It never goes anywhere, does it?
See, maybe he never had the talk about Birds and the Bees or something. He had no idea what to do. You know, like, okay, how are you?
Uh-huh.
Let's have some meaningful conversations and things like that, I suppose.
Jack Kevan, who was one of the main people behind making the creature, he eventually went into the cosmetics business, he told me. He said he made a career out of the cosmetics business, built a factory and plants, and had 2,000 distributors all over the world. He retired in 1979, and I always wanted to interview him, and I did have a few short conversations with him, but he wasn't big on swinging down memory lane, and I think you know why.
Yeah, he had some very bitter memories about working on some of these things. He never got the proper credit that he should have gotten. I mean, he's the guy that actually, if they were appliances, that actually did the appliance work and applied the appliances like Abbott Costello, Frankenstein, and Man of a Thousand Faces, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. And here again, Buddy Westmore got most of the credit because here again, he was the head of the makeup department. And mm-hmm. I think there was a little riff kind of started in there, and it got kind of worse instead of better.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Jack literally just got out of the business. He really did. He couldn't take it anymore, and he just didn't think it was very fair of all the stuff he had done. I think he really thought he should start getting a screen credit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after all the stuff that he did, he probably should have. But that wasn't studio policy in those days. That was the problem.
And when you met him and talked to him about these things, what was he like?
Very bitter.
Yeah.
He was a very bitter man. Yeah, he didn't really want to talk to... The only way I made the bridge is he liked Glenn Strange a lot, and I told him that Glenn was like my dad, and that kind of opened up an avenue to talk... He wouldn't even want to talk to me at first.
Right.
You know? And then he kind of opened up and said what a great guy Glenn was, and we kind of talked about it a little bit, but he was very bitter about it, and in fact, I should have followed up. He said, I've got a whole attic full of stills. If you want them, come over and pick them up. And I just didn't have the guts to call him back. I thought it was rubbing salt in the wound.
Mm-hmm.
So I just never did it. So I have no idea what happened to that stuff. But he was a nice guy. You know, mm-hmm. he went into the cosmetic business. He did quite well with that, I understand,
absolutely,
too.
You know, yeah.
He did okay. And he was a terrific makeup artist as well. I mean, mm-hmm. he was great in beauty makeup, and he really, really shined in this type of work. I
right.
mean, he really was
well,
very
Makeup
very
Artist good. Magazine, that's been around for years, right?
Yes.
Just a couple of years ago, they called... The creature, one of the 50 greatest makeups of all time, in a special issue on the greatest makeups of all time. And
yes.
Kevan's creature made the list.
Yes, indeed. You
mm-hmm.
know.
I talked to him also. I called him up and dying to get an interview, and he wasn't interested, and I tried to butter him up, and I don't know what I said that opened the door a little bit. You said Glenn Strange, but finally I must have said something that got him in a chatty mood. He did spend about 10 or 15 minutes on the phone with me talking about his career in very general terms, and I, of course, wanted more. So on my next trip to California, prior to it, I called him up again and reminded him who I was. And, he hemmed and hawed and said, well, call me when you're out here and I'll think about it. So I hold my breath and I get out there and I'm doing all my stuff and doing all my other interviews that I had lined up for that trip. And I finally call him and he is furious. He said, you were supposed to be here yesterday and I waited all day. And, I mean, they're, if I had been supposed to be there on a certain time, and I would have been there with bells on, and
sure.
and somehow he got it into his head that a day, I guess he said to himself, well, I guess I will let Weaver over, and he circled the date on the calendar as a good day for him, and then he forgot he never told me.
Oh, boy.
So I tried to calm him down, because, you know, I really respected the guy's work, and I didn't want him mad at me, and I hadn't done anything, so I managed to calm him down a little and eat dirt and placate him, and finally he said, well, call me again in a couple of days, and we'll see. And just like you, he was trying to be a nice guy, but he's so angry and bitter about his career that now he's got me shook up, so I never did call him back.
It was hurting to talk about it. So,
so that's why
I never followed up on this.
I let it go.
Now he's going to fight this cougar. He's mm-hmm. looking at it now. Cougar really looks mad. The thing is, in this film, too, well, even in the original films, pretty much, the creature never killed just to kill. I mean, he was just trying to survive, basically. And that's what he's doing here. And actually, he's protecting the sheep because he gets blamed for everything.
Of course.
Naturally. The monster always does. The monster always gets blamed for everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see they got him really shiny here, and he looks good when he's shiny.
Mm-hmm. William Allen, who came up with the idea for Creature in 1952, he didn't want to do the sequels. I mean, he wasn't a guy to say no to Universal. He wasn't a guy to stand up and fight and to not do something, so he did them. But he didn't think sequels were a good idea, and he said to me, he said it laughingly, but I could tell he was serious. He said, "I wish to disassociate myself with the other two films as much as possible." He said, "I blew those two pictures through my nose and didn't want to hear any more. And didn't want to hear any more about them." And he says he had very little to do with Revenge of the Creature. He was very honest that way. If his name was on a picture, he didn't have much to do with. He didn't even try to bluff. He just said, "You know, I gave the script to the director, whoever it was, and I had confidence that he would film what was in the script, and that was it." And he said that the sequels were the studio's idea, and this one in particular he was referring to. He said the whole idea behind it is make it so cheap that it wouldn't lose money.
Yep.
And although I'm sure audiences over the years have enjoyed Creature Walks Among Us, as always, you get the wise guys at the preview audiences.
Oh, yes.
It was Creature Walks Among Us was previewed at the State Theater in Los Angeles following a showing of Ransom with Glenn Ford on January 26, 1956. The preview, the whole audience is given cards with a lot of questions on them to fill out after the movie is over.
Right.
Which scene did you like most? One guy wrote the credits.
Whoa.
Which scenes, if any, did you dislike? Some of the answers were about jealousy, the factual scenes and the mushy scenes. Most was one guy's answer. Were all the story points clear to you? No, the reasons for the changes were not made clear enough, wrote one person. No, poor script. In fact, some lines ridiculous. Another guy, what story? Another guy, story? Did the picture hold your interest throughout? If not, where did it fail to hold you? From the beginning to the end, one guy wrote.
Tough audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tough audience.
Have to admit it, best comedy of the year. And then cards mailed into Universal. Good for children, one person wrote.
Ooh.
Color would have helped. At least I wouldn't have felt as though I were out $1. It is a poor way to present the subject of genetics. And this one I like. Best comedy in years. All it lacked was Abbott and Costello and Liberace.
Oh, good Lord.
So, wow. Tough audience.
Yeah, that's tough audience. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a tough house, man.
Right?
You don't want to play that house.
Oh, it must be a wife duck. Shut up and get out.
Here's Greg Palmer, just snotty to the end.
He is.
Going after the guy's wife and now rubbing Jeff Morrow's nose in it.
Oh, but he pays for it. He pays for it. And the poor creature gets blamed again. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, that poor guy has more trouble.
The censors, the censor warned Universal, don't have the pistol whipping on camera, and I don't know why. Universal did it anyway and obviously got away with it because
they
saw the first blow actually delivered on camera. And now here comes the action climax.
Here it is. Oh, he's ticked. Now they got him ticked. He said, that's it. I'm not taking the blame for this one. I killed the cougar, but I ain't taking the blame for this one. There ain't no way. I said, that's it. I'll put him in there.
Again, this was a situation where the early scripts were sort of different from the finished film. Most of them have the rampage through the house. But one script ends with Jeff Morrow escaping up onto the roof. And the creature hears him on the roof and pushes up through the beams and pushes up through the shingles and goes up onto the roof after him and throws him off the roof instead of throwing him off the balcony, which would have been kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then another script, I didn't care for this quite as much. Same thing. Creature rampage through the house, Morrow up onto the roof, creature through the beams, through the shingles, up onto the roof. Morrow gets away, goes down. He thinks, creature's afraid of the water now. He goes in the swimming pool. There was a swimming pool in that version of the script. He goes in the swimming pool thinking he can get away from the creature.
Wrong.
Creature's not that dumb. Even though creature can't breathe underwater anymore, he knows a swimming pool was no problem.
Right.
And he waded right in and killed Morrow in that version of the script.
Now, see here now, I think he does a really good job in here of the action and creating a mood with the creature. Here again, because it's a thing that doesn't move much. I mean, the face is tough. But he looks mean here. I mean, it's body English. Look at this. I mean, he looks like he's really ticked off, you know. Even though the creature itself, the expression's not changing at all. Really, but he has a way of doing it. Mm-hmm. This, I always love the scene with the couch. It it looks like it's really super strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's got to be on wires or cables
They had it all rigged on wires, I'm sure, to pull it around. But it looked.
And I'm sure it's also such a light material. I don't think it could have been a real couch.
Like, it was just a frame, you know, darn near balsa wood like that is too. I'm sure, you know.
Exactly.
But it looks great, you know.
And again, here's the part of the picture I talked about before. David Schechter pointed out that there was music written for this, performed, recorded, and then in the editing. In the editing process, they thought silence would be better.
I think it is better.
I do too. Absolutely.
Because her hysterical scene here is really great. I mean, you believe her. She looks like she's really hysterical. This is kind of a cool scene where he runs and he sees him running through the outside here. Do you think he's getting
away? This poor guy can't catch a break anymore.
No, he's had it now. Whoa, there he goes. Oh, that's a great scene. That is really a good scene.
And Jeff Morrow told me that it was actually him for being picked up.
Yeah.
And see all the flower pots on the balcony?
Yep, sure do.
Ledge, and now no flower pots.
Yep, they're gone.
There's a blooper, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Morrow told me he was picked up by wires by McGowan, but then he said, fortunately, they did use a dummy. Also, he said on the day that they shot this scene, he comes in to do the scene, and they hand him a whole bunch of pieces of paper that he thought were going to be new lines and new dialogue to learn, in a few minutes before they had the shoot. And, he's a little horrified by that, and he opens it up, and they gave him a map of the house, of the sets, because of all the running around. They gave him a map to help him line up how he'd play the scene, and it wasn't dialogue at all.
I hear the sparks going here, the stuff going. That's one of the Frankenstein sound effects. That's the electronic equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So, they pulled it out of their sound effects library and used it. Hey, it worked great. Now, this is sad. This ending is, I think, very, very sad with the poor creature here. He knows he can really never go back in the water, but he really wants to. And so here again, now this shows, with body English again, he actually pulled it off that the creature was had feelings.
Mm-hmm.
He actually had feelings. And even though it's a non-pliable face, his body English and his eye, the eye expressions does show.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely sad.
And the situations and the music,
It all works. It's an emotional thing. It really works. I mean, you really feel sorry for him because you know he can't ever go back in the water. He's heading for it again.
Mm-hmm.
And you surmise he probably drowns, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
There was never another sequel, thank goodness.
In the original script, the wardrobe for the burned creature was long sleeves, high neck sweatshirt.
Of course.
Tight and form-fitting. I'm not sure that would have worked as well.
No.
And one other interesting thing about the movie, again, from an early script, here's a dialogue of Marcia, Jeff Morrow's, Dr. Barton's wife, talking to Rex Reason, talking about her husband. He was trying to change me to think as he thinks, speak as he wants, to be remade into some perfect thing, some terrible secret ideal he desires. So they get across, in that version of the script, they wanted to get across with that dialogue that in addition to trying to transform the creature, he was also trying to transform his Alden wife, and that's where all the problems come from. And this is Brown Hill on the Universal backlot that he's coming up to the top of.
Oh, this is so sad. This is really very sad here, because this rear projection thing right here, look at that. I mean, his body, you can just tell, his breathing, everything he's doing here, he's sad. He's very sad, and it works. It really works. And I applaud him. He did a great job in this.
Yeah. So it's got some good action scenes very, very striking, downbeat, strange ending.
It is. Yeah, it is a downbeat ending, but a very realistic one, too. It's definitely worth having.
I mean, mm-hmm.
It's good in the trilogy. It finishes it off, and it does make an end to it.
Oh, it certainly does. maybe not the end fans would have wanted.
No,
certainly
but it
certainly a very offbeat ending to a very very interesting, marvelous.
Now, did they take us back to the home now? Are we through, and they're going to take us out of here? And
I think we got to find our own way back to the home.
I think that's it.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you.